And this event is being recorded for later broadcast on Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM in New York's Upper Hudson Valley and streamed online at wgxc.org/listen. A recording of this event will also be posted at wgxc.org, and all of this will be in our chat feature. We want to thank Lynn over at the radio station for doing this for us. It's very exciting. And now it's my honor to introduce our wonderful Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, who is the highest ranking female elected official in state government in New York. Kathy is committed to serving all New Yorkers by visiting all 62 counties every year, tracking enough miles to go around the earth 7.5 times. Incredible. She's representing Governor Cuomo as she makes this trip around the world, which is our world, and building support for their initiatives across New York. Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul is the first Democratic woman to serve two terms as Lieutenant Governor, winning re-election in November 2018. She's also the first elected woman chair of the DLGA, heading the most diverse group of Democratic lieutenant governors ever. And there are many other things, but I'm just going to mention this. The last thing I'll say, she's co-chair of Governor Cuomo's Child Care Availability Task Force. And in April of this year, she was tasked with spearheading the COVID-19 public health response and reopening strategy for Western New York. She continues to hold Washington accountable and ensure all New Yorkers are protected as she leads economic development and upstate revitalization in post-pandemic recovery efforts. Please welcome our wonderful Lieutenant Governor, Kathy Hochul.
Well, thank you, Anne, and to all the members of the Columbia County Women's Association, a brand new idea. I know you just started a few months ago, but ingenious. I mean, an organization that's dedicated to electing women candidates, but also promoting social justice for all. And I think you're going to have a lot on your plate because in both areas, there's much work to be done. But two areas that I've dedicated most of my life to, and I'm really happy to join this cause tonight, but also to support the candidates that you're featuring. You have some of my all-star favorite people on this call. And let me start with my good friend, Kirsten Gillibrand. It was just a month and a half ago that we traveled the state together. We were in the Hudson Valley area talking about the need for affordable childcare, something that I believe in, but she has been a tireless advocate for at the federal level to make sure that the money starts flowing to the states for these essential services, and how hard it's been on working moms, particularly during this pandemic. So we are blessed to have her as our senator. So let's just get a little extra round of applause to Kirsten Gillibrand for taking the time out of her work. She's in Washington right now, and she still finds time and never forget where she came from in her former congressional district. Also, Assembly Member Carmen De La Rosa, I know she's joined us to help moderate our panel of candidates from Columbia County. Thank you for doing this. My great friend Dee Dee Barrett, we see each other all the time at many announcements and spend time together as part of that very small but elite group of women elected officials in our state capitol. So great to see Dee Dee on the call. And our two new members who I look forward to being at their swearing in. And that would be our candidates, Betsy Kratt and Brittany Vogel. So I look forward to hearing from them this evening as well. I'll just give you some quick reflections on why it's so essential that we do elect more women to office. And the fact that we now have 32, almost 33% of the state legislature is now comprised of women. We can high five that and get real excited, since when I was first elected as Lieutenant Governor a few short years ago, it was only 29%. But unfortunately, and I'm not the best at math, but at that rate, I'll probably be long gone before we get real parity, which should at least be 50%. So I want to speed up this process. I want to get more women, first of all, interested in running. I know why a lot of them don't want to run for office. And unfortunately, childcare, who's watching the kids when they go out to the barbecues and knock on doors and go out to the farm markets and try to meet voters. I mean, this has always been a weight on women's shoulders. Who's watching the children so they can even campaign? Also, women don't want to necessarily raise money. It's not a fun thing to do, but unfortunately, until there's full public financing of campaigns, something I've championed since I was a young staffer for Senator Moynihan ages ago, we still have to do it. It's a necessary part of the process unless you can self-finance, and God bless you if you can do that. Also, a lot of people don't want to be part of a really rough and tumble male-dominated business. I get that. Senator Gillibrand gets that. But okay, it's like a woman who goes into tech or a woman who goes into construction. I mean, we're not the only ones. And there's nobody tougher than women. When we have an opportunity to get into an arena and start rolling up our sleeves, putting on the gloves and battling it out, we'll fight for our communities. We'll fight for healthcare for our kids. We'll fight for good education in our schools. We'll fight for anybody, because that's what we do innately. We fight for other people. So we need more women to be in the power, in the corridors of power, whether it's Washington, whether it's our state capital, which is what we're talking about tonight, all the way down to local government. I started as a town board member, went to county office before I went to Congress, and now state office. So every level needs to have more women engaged, because we bring a different perspective. It's not about the power that we amass or the fancy title we want to be in front of our name. And that does motivate some of the men, for sure, because I've certainly met those guys. Women do it for a different reason. It's not about a career. It's about a passion. It's about a calling. And when they have that chance to be in those rooms and to make decisions, you know they're going to do what's best for our families and for our kids and for our farmers who've been knocked around and for our small businesses that are really suffering, particularly now more than ever. There is so much human suffering out there, that people are going through depression. They've lost their jobs. There is so much work we have to do. Also, in this environment where finally the issue of racial justice is coming to the forefront, people are acknowledging there have been so many historic wrongs that we have this chance now to right. Women are the ones who can lead those conversations and get the job done. So I am looking forward to having yet two more new members of the assembly join Dee Dee Barrett in representing Columbia County, because it will make a profound difference. And I'm just gonna call on every one of you, and I think I'm speaking to the converted here, but you know some other people outside, the people who are participating tonight. We have to get so many more people out to vote this November. It is the election of a lifetime, and I know you hear that from everybody. It's the most important election of your life. If you don't believe that now, you'll never believe it. Because what's happening in Washington, why Senator Gillibrand has to go into battle every single day to fight for our state, it's not necessary. If we had Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, how exciting is that to have a woman to be our first female vice president this year? We need to have them at the forefront, because they'll be the ones who can help states like New York get through this pandemic and give us the resources to fund our schools, our teachers, our first responders, our healthcare workers, and childcare workers. They all need federal assistance, and it's not going to happen with Donald Trump in position. It's not going to help happen unless Chuck Schumer is the majority leader and that we maintain Nancy Pelosi as our speaker. So there are so many important issues out there, but Governor Cuomo and I are looking for even more partners in our state assembly, people who understand what democratic values are all about and will act upon them. So I am so much looking forward to having new members, new female members. And we do get together a few times a year. We have our women's caucus meeting, and it used to be a real small gathering. And I love the fact that we have to keep putting more chairs at the tables, because we're electing more and more women, and women of all ages stepping up to run to serve their communities. Because as someone who's been elected for over 26 years, I know that there's no higher calling than to serve the people of your community, and you do it with such heart and passion. So thanks for the opportunity to say hello. I'll let you know when I'm in town again, coming up real soon. And thank you for forming this, and Ann and everybody involved. Great concept, great idea, but let's put some real action behind this idea of having a women's organization and make sure that we elect the incredible women who are being featured tonight in November. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That was a great honor. For our senator from the great state of New York, I have a huge page of things to say about her accomplishments, but I know she has to get back into the Senate. So I can certainly read this all to you later. Let me just say, thank God for Kirsten Gillibrand, and stay in that Senate and keep working for us. And I'm going to turn it over to you now.
Well, thank you, Ann. Thank you so much for hosting. Thank you to all the extraordinary women on this call. So many really amazing women leaders and advocates. Thank you to Kathy Hochul for being such a great lieutenant governor who truly understands the struggles that families face around the state. I had the real pleasure of getting to know Kathy when she ran for Congress and got to welcome her into the Congress and helped her campaign. She's a fighter, and our governor is very blessed to have her alongside him to help. Kathy and I like to travel together. We travel across the state talking about issues that matter, city and state money from this next COVID package, the importance of childcare. We also travel the state talking about sexual violence on college campuses. And so we are allies. And this group really represents the importance of women collaborating together to make a difference. We need more women running for office up and down the ticket from the most local city council race to mayors, to assembly members and senators, to Congress members, governors. And that's all in our future. So I'm very excited about everyone on the call and all the races that you've won already and that you've run already. Because sometimes you run and don't win, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't stop there. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't run again. I know that very well, in fact. I think it's exciting that Columbia County has this organization, because Columbia County is a place that should be blue. And it is blue when women get organized and get involved and become advocates and elected leaders. Women very much are the binding force in every community. They understand where the ties are that bind us. Most people care deeply about access to healthcare and access to a good education and access to a decent job to provide for their families. Those are the commonalities of all communities, whether they're Democrat or Republican. And women fundamentally know that as stewards of their community, as people who run their families, they know what people need. I really loved living in Columbia County. I had a home in Hudson for about 7 years, and I absolutely loved every minute of it. I still drive by my old house from time to time. And I was just in Hudson a few weeks ago and had a blast. I saw the mayor and had lunch at one of my favorite, or dinner at one of my favorite restaurants, Kamea. And so Hudson is still thriving right in the center of Columbia County, and it's wonderful. I've seen some businesses close and some businesses open, but there's always a flow, and the flow never stops. And I really admire that about Hudson. And I admire it about the rural areas of Columbia County as well. Our farmers have had a tough time, but they are vocal, and I talk to them regularly about what it would take to be successful. And so we constantly are trying to create the atmosphere so that our rural communities can survive and thrive. So I just want to thank everyone on this call. I remember my first campaign for Congress. It was families and women in Columbia County that made all the difference, knocking on doors and making phone calls. I think by election day, we were knocking on 20,000 doors every weekend and making 10,000 phone calls every night. And that's what it takes to win back then a 2-1 Republican district. We're lucky now that the district is about 50-50. It's a little easier to win, but I just want to thank you guys who in the dog days of summer and fall really did produce the grassroots activism that was necessary to win. And we won this district twice. Before I became senator. So I just want to thank everyone on the call. There's a lot of friends on this call, a lot of familiar faces, and it's a real privilege and pleasure to see you and allow me to thank you for the support you're giving to other candidates and the grassroots organizing work you're doing every day. So thank you very much.
Senator, thank you so much. And we hope you'll come back for a future event and talk about your Off the Sidelines program, because that was really what I wanted to talk about tonight.
Well, I can give you a quick report if you'd like. So yes. Off the Sidelines, I started 8 years ago to ask women to get involved in politics, to ask them to run for office, if not run, then support a woman who would run, to become advocates and to vote. And over the last 8 years, we've raised over $8 million for women candidates, more than $1 million for women of color candidates. And it's been a wonderful organizing principle such that we've been able to create giving circles around the country. And those are basically groups of women between 20 women and 75 women, and they host candidates that come through their towns. Those giving circles on top of the 8 million I've already raised an additional 8 million. So women are really stepping up to really impact the national dialogue by electing candidates that share their values. Off the sidelines has also been instrumental in lifting up candidates early, before they are endorsed by Emily's List, before they're endorsed by the DCCC. Those are candidates that we can get to know quickly and say, you're going to make a difference, and support them. And so it's been a huge opportunity for me to meet all these young, and not always young, but new women who are running for Congress or running for Senate, and give them the leg up they need to be successful. And it's worked. It's been extremely effective. And I think every senator who's been elected since I started it had the benefit of off the sidelines. Every House member who's been elected newly in the last 8 years has had the benefit of it, and it's worked. So it's been a pleasure and a real privilege. And I truly believe that when we get to 51% of women in Congress, we will be far more effective, because women are so good at finding common ground, at building consensus, and putting things on the agenda that, frankly, our male colleagues never focus on, whether it's national paid leave or equal pay for equal work or affordable daycare or universal pre-K. These are ideas and examples of really groundbreaking policies that would change the economy forever that for some reason never get on the top 10 list. When women are 51% of Congress, they will be, and they will be law. It's a lot of the reasons why I actually ran for president, because I wanted this agenda to be part of the national debate. And frankly, it never is. And so I felt like my candidacy pushed a lot of ideas forward so that our now nominee, Joe Biden, can carry that mantle and be successful in not only becoming our next president, but actually marshaling really transformative ideas about how to make the economy work for everyone. And so I'm very excited about the future. I think we have a huge shot of flipping the Senate. We're up in 6 races. We only need 4, and we're up in 6. And we have another 6 that are close behind. So we have a dozen candidates that are truly in play for the US Senate. And the polling just came out today that Joe Biden's ahead in a ton of states. So ahead in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, which matters. If he wins those 3 states, he wins the election. So we just have to keep pushing where we can in Columbia County for our local candidates, but also just helping the presidential and helping the Senate races.
Thank you so much. And I just want to say about Off the Sidelines, it's not just women, but you're working with girls too. And that's our future. And it's so great that you do that.
For sure. Well, God bless you, Anne. And thank you, everybody, for being on the call. I'm indebted and so grateful to all of you. I wouldn't be your senator without you. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Let's give a hand to Senator Joe LeBrand.
God bless.
Thank you. See you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's start this part of our program now. That was very exciting to have Lieutenant Governor Hochul, who I believe is staying with us for the program, and Senator Gillibrand. Pretty exciting night for me, I can tell you that. But now we're going to talk about a very exciting person, and that's Assemblywoman Carmen De La Rosa. And she's in the New York State Assembly, obviously. She was elected in November of 2016 and inaugurated in January of 2017. She represents the communities of Inwood, Washington Heights, and Marble Hill in Northern Manhattan. She's a member of many, many committees. And along with that, she chairs the Subcommittee on Infrastructure. And she was elected as first vice chair of the Legislative Women's Caucus in 2019. And there's a long list, if you Google her, there's a long list of legislative accomplishments to her credit also. In 2018, Speaker Carl Hastie appointed Assemblywoman De La Rosa to serve as a member of a special task force convened with the purpose of creating anti-sexual harassment legislation for New York State. This month, Assemblywoman De La Rosa launched her campaign for New York City Council in District 10. And that election is next June 2021. So we wish you all the best. And now I'm going to turn the program over to our guest, Assemblywoman Carmen De La Rosa, to introduce her panel. Welcome.
Thank you. I want to thank the Columbia County Women's Alliance and all of you for being here tonight. It's an honor to join you. I want to thank Senator Gillibrand and Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul for being with us. And most of all, I want to thank all the women who have taken on the plight of running to represent their communities. As women, and as we heard our senator say, we are at the forefront of our communities. And tonight, we're going to hear from candidates who are looking to be elected to the New York State Assembly to make a difference in what is happening in our state. In a moment of crisis, as women, we have been taught to lead. And so I look forward to getting to know these candidates as we introduce them to the community tonight. So I will be introducing the distinguished panel, starting with my friend and colleague, Assemblymember Dede Barrett. Dede Barrett has represented the 106th Assembly District in New York State since 2012 and is running for her sixth term. She's a strong advocate for Hudson Valley region and recognizes the unique issues that are part of the rural community. Dede has been a longtime proponent of getting more women involved in running for public office and has been outspoken in her support for childcare access in New York State and a longtime supporter of Planned Parenthood. As the chair of the Assembly's Veterans Committee, Dede has tirelessly advocated for female veterans as they transition back into civilian life. And as a resident of Cloverack, we are happy to call Dede Barrett our Assemblywoman and our neighbor. It is my honor to introduce our State Assembly member, Dede Barrett. Dede will have 7 minutes to introduce herself. Dede.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much, Carmen. This has just been such a great buildup. I want to thank not only Carmen, but my friends, the Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul and Senator Gillibrand, who I drove my then in high school son to intern when she first ran for Congress. I was living in Dutchess County at the time and back and forth to Hudson to work in that office. And to all of you, so many friends and supporters here that are part of the evening, but part of also forming the Columbia County Women's Alliance, which I know has been a germ of an idea for since Kirsten first ran for Congress. I remember the conversations then. So it's great to see you all here tonight, and I'm thrilled to have two other Democratic women running for the Assembly in Columbia County, Betsy and Brittany. And how awesome would that be to have a local sisterhood to join the remarkable and diverse group of women I've been honored to serve with in the New York State Legislature. As the Lieutenant Governor said, it's really been an extraordinary group. And as the chair of the Legislative Women's Caucus, I've been thrilled to work with her closely and have her join and participate in so many of our Legislative Women Caucus events. And last year, when we celebrated the centennial of the first two women seated in the New York State Legislature, the ages of our legislators, our women legislators, ranged from 29 years old to 84. So we are a rich and diverse and remarkable group of women. And I look forward to Betsy and Brittany joining us, and Carmen. And I guess, I don't know, this is news to me, Carmen, that you're running for city council. So I have to process that piece. But I am, as Carmen said, running for re-election, and I love my district. I feel so honored and blessed to represent this very beautiful district that's part Columbia, part Dutchess County. When I was first elected in 2012, I was the first woman and the first Democrat to represent this region. And you know, at the moment, I'm still the only Democrat representing this region in state government. So some allies, I'm definitely overdue. One of my most joyful initiatives has been an annual booklet that my office puts up on women's history, and we publish it every March, and we tell the stories of 10 different women from the region, from Dutchess and Columbia counties, who are no longer alive, who have impacted our region or our state or our country, or in the case of one of the first people, Eleanor Roosevelt, the world. And if anybody wants to see that, it's on my Assembly website. They're all 6 issues that we have done are online there, and they're really inspiring because these are the women who came before us on whose shoulders we stand all the time. I've been honored this year, in addition to chairing the Legislative Women's Caucus, to chair the Veterans Affairs Committee, which has given me an opportunity to work on issues surrounding women veterans, which I know is an issue close to Senator Gillibrand's heart, but also to work on mental and behavioral health issues, because I truly believe that these are profound issues in our communities, and we've seen it even more in this COVID era, but that my hope is by working with veterans and normalizing these issues, that we will help eliminate the stigma for the greater population and ensure that we have the services and the parity for mental health with physical health as we treat people going forward. And it's been a real honor to serve as chair of Veterans Affairs, and I'm very proud of the legislation that we've been able to pass that is groundbreaking and really has put New York State ahead of a lot of other states in the work that we're doing. One of the other key issues that I've worked on, as you know, we all are very keen on the importance of childcare, reliable and safe childcare, and we're seeing it even more right now, because even young people who used to not be, you didn't have to worry about them because they were in school, are now out of school and need childcare on top of during their in-school time as well as their out-of-school time, and many families are struggling with this issue. But we in this state are really facing a looming crisis on the continuum of caregiving, and this is very much a women's issue. Caregivers are historically women, women of color, women from immigrant communities, daughters, granddaughters, sisters, wives, and we don't have an infrastructure. We don't have a workforce. We don't have the transportation in these rural areas. We're really not set up to address the childcare or the continuum care. When you have families, whether it's young people with disabilities or older people with disabilities, when you're dealing with older relatives, it's a crisis that we've seen. I was part of a press conference with a number of our Hudson Valley senators not too long ago that the caring majority hosted. And, you know, we have really a looming crisis here in the Hudson Valley. So that's something that the Legislative Women's Caucus is preparing a series of roundtables on. We had planned one in March. It got shut down by COVID, but we're coming back virtually to do this as a series to start addressing all of these issues. And I look forward to continuing to work with the Lieutenant Governor and the Senator on raising the issue of childcare and caregiving to the level that it needs to be. It's economic development, it's social justice, it's safety and the well-being of our families. It's a profound issue that crosses so many areas, and we need to get it right, and we need to get it on the front burner in New York State. In the COVID era, we did a lot of work with our constituents on helping small businesses and helping of course, people who are unemployed. This was just a really devastating to so much of our region. But one of the other issues that really got amplified in the COVID crisis is the need for better broadband. We still here in Columbia County are struggling with inadequate broadband in too many of our areas. And in 2016, I first invited Governor Cuomo's office. His broadband office came and heard about the issue here, and a couple of years later, he came back and he said, you know, we're going to do it. Columbia County is going to be a priority. A few years later, I got the state controller to audit PSC's oversight of the Charter Spectrum merger, which has been a, you know, debacle in lots of ways. But we still really are not, you know, adequately covered here in Columbia County. Both school students and college students and parents working at home, that's obviously raised one issue. But another issue that we've heard during this the shut-in is how important telemedicine and remote health and mental health services are, but it only works when you've got adequate broadband or you've got cell service or you can afford to have the technology to do that. And we are continuing to work with the governor's team and with the Congressman Delgado's office on this, because it's got to be a combination of local and federal and state help to make this happen. It's, you know, a lot of the money has been already paid out, and so the providers are not feeling the incentive to to work with the government on this, but you know, we've got to change that around because we're not there yet. We're also doing a lot of work on the census. You know, we have only a couple more weeks. Columbia County is only at 53%, which is not enough. It not only will it impact our representation, we worked so hard to get Congressman Delgado elected, and now, you know, run the risk of a district that will be even more difficult for him to win next time. We need the money for our schools, for our municipalities, for our first responders. It is so important that we get out that everybody gets counted, and we're not seeing it at this point. So, you know, in these last few weeks, I hope everybody will do what they can to make that happen. In addition, we're working on a smart housing initiative with Homes and Community Renewal, which is an affordable, energy efficient home ownership model, which will initially hopefully work in my more rural communities, but I think it's a model that will also be very effective as infill housing for cities and hamlets and other more densely populated areas across the state of New York. Our carbon farming pilot is working now, is flourishing in 5 counties here in the Hudson Valley. We continue to work on Lyme and tick-borne diseases, which we're working now with a group from Central New York, the Central New York Lyme and Tick-Borne Alliance, which is doing some great work and hoping that we can build more motivation for New York State to be a leader on the information and the prevention and eradication of Lyme and tick-borne diseases. And, you know, I will continue to advocate and support my beautiful district and here in the Hudson Valley. I just feel so honored to have this really extraordinary, engaged community of so much history and so much beautiful nature and agricultural resources and cultural richness. And I'm just, you know, every day I look out at the Catskills in one direction and the Berkshires in the other, and I feel so blessed. So thank you all for your support. Thank you for everything that you all do. And I look forward to continuing to work with all of you as we go forward and get out the vote on election day, either early voting or on the day of, so we have a blue wave to show for election day. So thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Dee Dee. Thank you for your leadership and for your bravery as we travel these crisis moments. I want to introduce the next candidate, Betsy Crack, who will have 5 minutes to introduce herself. But before she begins, I'd like to say that Betsy is a lifelong resident of Ulster and Greene counties. She's a single mother of 2 teenage twin sons and a tireless advocate for underserved New York communities. Her campaign is centered around the fight for education, workers' rights, and equal access to healthcare. Betsy believes that the skills of social workers that social workers bring to the table, listening, empathy, problem solving, and community building, are critically important and must prevail in the state assembly. Her prior experience includes working with the Girl Scouts of Ulster County, Family of Woodstock, and Citizens Action for Hudson Valley. Please welcome Betsy Crack.
Hi, everybody. It's so great to be here. Thanks so much for having me. I only have 2 towns in Columbia County. As a result of, they gerrymandered me right across the river into Stockport and Stuyvesant. So who knows what's going to happen next time around, but you know, it'll be a loss for sure. Columbia County has been so wonderful and supportive, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to speak to you all. In February, it looked like no one was going to run for this seat, and I thought about it and I thought, why not? I wanted to try to bring what I'd learned and my experience as not only an advocate for people for underserved communities, but for my own experience being in those communities as well. My twins are born at 27 weeks. So they were in the hospital for a long time. And after they came home, we learned the early intervention, SSI, WIC kind of web of services. And then from there, we went into, you know, IEPs and things like that. So a lot of knowledge there, a lot of experience that I've been happy to share with other parents. And then also, you know, like many women, after my marriage ended, my living situation changed dramatically. So in addition to those services, also learning networking things like Snap and Heap and how to navigate that kind of world. Right now I live in public housing. People who've never lived in public housing think it's bad. My experience in public housing has been great. I would love to see public housing fully funded in our state. One thing that I was really happy to see in my preparation materials for tonight was that there's affordable housing is a topic that we're going to discuss, and I'm really excited to talk about that because my work as a housing advocate really taught me a lot about affordable housing and what it means in a rural community as opposed to an urban community. So I was very heartened to see that first-time home ownership was not mentioned at all, which is fantastic for a housing advocate to see, because frequently home ownership is promoted as the solution to a lack of affordable housing. It's not. First-time home buyer programs are fantastic for people who want to buy homes, but there's a lot of us who just aren't good candidates for home ownership. Like, I'll raise my hand right here. I'm a single parent. Still finding my feet after the end of my marriage, finishing school, raising my children, you know, not ready to add, you know, what happens if the roof starts to leak to that list of challenges. So I'm really excited to talk about that tonight with all of you. And I think that's it from this end.
Thank you, Betsy. Thank you so much for sharing your story. So our next candidate is Brittany Vogel. She's running for the 107th District. Brittany is a working class woman that leads over 120 essential employees in the retail industry. At 23, she founded a nonprofit making birthday cakes for children living in poverty, and she's now running for office to continue her passion of helping others. She's endorsed by Planned Parenthood, Capital Women, Eleanor's Legacy, and you can trust Brittany to be on your side in the assembly as she fights to ensure women's rights and reproductive freedoms remain protected. Welcome, Brittany.
Thank you so much, Carmen. And thank you for Anne for hosting this event, the CWCA for hosting this. It was great to hear from Kirsten Gillibrand and Kathy Hochul. I think that was fantastic to have them a part of this event. I'll talk about myself as a candidate and why I'm running for office, but this being a women's event, I think it's most important for me to talk about why I'm here. And that's, you know, one of the main reasons is because of my mom. We come from a working class background, like Carmen said. My mom was 33 years old when my parents separated, and she raised two children, making $22,000 a year. So money was always tight in our house. She always struggled how to pay the bills, how to, keep food on the table and all that stuff. So it's really important to me, running for office, that we have that kind of perspective in the assembly where, people understand the fundamental things that aren't being addressed in the assembly, where, how do we take care of working people? How do we take care of the working moms who are trying to keep a house over their children's heads and really provide for them to get an education that they're trying to get? My mom was always adamant about me getting an education, and I only have my associates from Hudson Valley, but it meant so much to me, being the first one in my generation, in my family, to get a degree. I didn't want to have all the student loan debts to get a bachelor's, so I decided not to continue my education. In lieu of advancing my career where I was working, learning leadership skills, and I'll segue that to my experience being a leader at a grocery store in one of the poorest areas of my district, and the things that I've experienced, the things that I've seen, has really brought me to the table to where I am today, because I'm so tired of seeing the struggles, what everyone's going through. And I really do believe, and I have a vision that, there can be a better world for working people, especially working moms, working and the children, like Carmen said, I started a nonprofit at 23 years old. After I was working as a bakery manager and was talked to by some of the food banks and food pantries in the area that the cakes that we were donating were getting damaged and how reliant those kids were on those birthday cakes and how the families, you know, couldn't afford their own birthday cakes and couldn't celebrate. So, you know, I used my skills as a cake decorator. I didn't have many skills back then, but I knew how to decorate cakes. Everyone that was advocating for me, you know, start my own bakery. I decided, how can I use my skills and actually do something good for the community? And so I started doing that, delivering to pantries all over the area, gave me a lot of connections, gave me a lot of insights, even further into how our struggling families are in these neighborhoods, you know, where they're struggling day by day to get food. And the kids are suffering. And how can a kid, you know, study and focus on learning when they're hungry? So all of those things, you know, kept compiling over my experience. Being an assistant store manager, I have associates coming to me every single day with the issues that they're dealing with and things that I've experienced, you know, just living through their shoes. One of the major things that that really touches me every single time I think about it, and it breaks my heart every time I think about it, is the associate. She was only like 2 years younger than me. She was working in my department. I was still a bakery manager at the time. And I found out one day that her mother had died of an overdose. That kind of experience, it just rocks your entire world. You know, you think about your mom and how similar in age they are and what would that be if that was my mom and what she must be feeling and how, you know, her entire world is just turned over. And she didn't deserve that. You know, the opioid epidemic has destroyed our, you know, Columbia County, Rensselaer, our whole entire state. It's one of those things that I'll be advocating for. You know, I have a cousin who's currently, she is in jail for heroin addiction and crimes related to heroin addiction. So I know personally, you know, up front, what the heroin epidemic and the opioid epidemic has done to this community. And I will fight to make sure that we are getting the rehabilitation that these patients need, because I see it as a health problem, not a criminal problem, and what we can do for them. And then I also, I have an associate who's 76 years old, and she is going to probably work until she passes away. That's what she tells me. You know, she's never going to be able to retire. She has a husband who's, you know, right at the beginnings of her dementia and Alzheimer's, either one, I'm not exactly sure, but, and she comes to me crying, upset, worried, you know, concerned, who's going to take care of him? How do I have those services to take care of him when I still need to work with, there's no money in the bank, there's no savings. And these are the conversations I'm having in my office every single day. It's like being in the assembly, honestly. And that's the kind of work that I want to do in the assembly is have those kind of conversations with people and see what they've been dealing with and then what we can do to help. I care about, you know, a lot of things. Food stamps, I know that Betsy touched on that. And we talked about this in our last event. I've helped people connect with to get to food pantries and get them food stamps or because they weren't getting enough food stamps. One of my associates was only getting $17 a month for food stamps, and that was not enough for him. He was literally starving. He was coming to my office, you know, do you have anything that I can, you know, can I make a sandwich, anything, you know, and that broke my heart too. You know, how do people not deserve to eat? These basic fundamental things that government should be providing, we're not providing. And then I had another one that she was dealing with a domestic violence situation, and she was doing everything in her power to get out of that situation. And she came to me in confidence and wanted me to do whatever, you know, I you know, stepped right up and said, what can I do for you? How can I help you? So she was able to get it out of that situation. We were able to get her to the food pantry. I gave her my bike so she could travel back and forth from work just to stay away from him and get away from the situation. So I'll bring that passion and commitment and empathy and understanding and caring, and I'll listen and I'll do what needs to be done for our community to make it, you know, a better place for us so that we can live out our lives without the struggles, you know, the struggles that don't need to be there that have held us back. I see so much potential in my stores, my associates, especially my female young associates that have kids trying to make a better world for themselves, but are being held back by the systems. I want to help remove those barriers and do what we can for our future generations and for the people that, you know, want more in life. So that's why I'm running. So thank you guys.
Thank you so much, Brittany, and to all the panelists. We see that these are women who are truly already doing the work in our communities. And we're gonna jump right in because I know we are on a crunch for time. We're gonna start talking about childcare. I'm going to make a quick summary of each issue, and then I'm going to ask a question of the panelists. You'll have 3 minutes to respond to the questions. So childcare, we all know that finding affordable childcare is an ongoing struggle for families across our state and in the county. COVID-19 has only exacerbated those issues with schools not going back into live session and the demand for childcare increasing at every turn. We know, and the Economic Policy Institute has said, that childcare is the sixth highest in the country in New York, and it's one of the biggest expenses that family must pay for. It's sometimes more expensive than sending a child to college. The employees who are providing childcare are oftentimes living in poverty themselves and don't have enough money to pay for adequate childcare. So what can we do in order to bring the solution of childcare to the forefront? We know that early childhood education is based around the care that a child gets in those early years, the formative years. And this is a huge issue when it comes to the workforce and bringing women back to work. And we wanna make sure that we can have solutions. So the question for the entire panel is, the first question is, what can our counties do to establish immediate assistance to working class parents who have no solution and may have to stay unemployed in order to care for their children? We'll start with Assembly Member Dee Dee Barrett.
Well, this is an issue, obviously, you know, that I started talking about in my remarks as well. You know, I really hope that New York State will look at a more holistic approach to childcare, because we, you know, when we look at it as, you know, just supporting particular socioeconomic sector, we leave out other parts that where the need is you know is equally there, and so many families are just at that tipping point where they could say I can afford this, I'm paying for stuff, but then somebody gets sick, or you know the car breaks down, or you need a new you know water heater or something, and the whole world falls apart. So I think we have to do something more along the lines of you know of paid family leave, but that supports that really looks at childcare as one of the things that we, you know, that government in combination with the private sector will support. We, you know, I've seen some models, and this is something that I've, you know, just been kind of steeping myself into across the state. There's some models that are really effective, because you have, say, a childcare provider that's, you know, in almost in the, either in the same building or right, you know, in the same complex as, say, a healthcare facility or a senior care facility, and you have a workforce that feels safe putting their children in this childcare center while they're providing the care for the, you know, the elder care or, you know, some other their nurses in hospital or something like that, so that you really start putting together solutions that work on multiple levels. And I, you know, I had a bill and was advancing in the budget last year, an innovation fund that I was hoping New York State, you know, that we could fund over a 3-year period to look at solutions that were working and how we might then model those across the state at different levels. Because I think even now, you know, and I know I've had this conversation with Carmen in the past, I mean, New York State can come in and, you know, and put a whole bunch of regulations in, and then you end up putting out of business small little childcare centers in neighborhoods that are the livelihood for that woman and her family and her children, and are working for the community surrounding it, but it may not be you know, the perfect model that would work in, say, a rural area or something like that. So I think we really have to be looking at this in a whole much more holistic way that, you know, that understands its essential part of the of economic development and economic stability in our communities.
Thank you, Dee Dee. Brittany, do you want to add anything for Betsy?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, you know, I really think that we need to rethink our economy in general. You know, how we think of childcare today is not the way we thought about it in the 1950s, where we had one person staying at home, watching the kids and, you know, taking care of them. We live in a completely different world. And yet our infrastructure and our government institutions and our, you know, programs, they haven't really caught up to where we are today. So I really think that we need to invest in, you know, I believe in a universal childcare program, tie it to early education, tie it to our education system, where we're getting those kids in early, you know, those critical years of developing, you know, those critical skills they need to develop into meeting all of their potentials as adults. I think we need to, you know, prioritize that. If you want a good, a well-working economy, it's how are we taking care of the people in the economy? And that is our kids. You know, how are we forming those foundations for them? I'll also say for short term, you know, with the COVID, where's the data? Like, we need the information that how many parents right now are in that situation where there's, you know, they can't work because of their kids aren't in school or their kids have a health risk. I think we need to do a lot more research and understand where we are in the moment. I like Dee Dee's idea of the tying it to paid family leave. That was one of the things that I thought of as well, you know, giving them that unemployment, making sure that they can still pay their bills and keep the roof over their head and feed their families. You know, that needs to be core. We're not in a normal time. We're in those unprecedented times. And we need support from the federal government. You know, that's why it's more important than anything that we elect Joe Biden. We are not going to get the support from Donald Trump that we need. You know, he doesn't care about the blue states. So if we don't elect Joe Biden, you know, we're going to have the, it's going to be a much tougher road. But we need solutions before then. And I'll do whatever I can to try to figure out, you know, the right solutions and how we can do what's best for our kids and our families that are struggling. Because I really do believe, you know, I work in a grocery store. I have a lot of employees right now. They're like, are they going to stay in school? What's going to happen? You know, how can they tell me that my kids have to go on? My one kid goes on these days. My other kid goes on these days. You know, there's a lot of chaos and things that they're still trying to work out. They're concerned. So I'm already listening to it. I'm already hearing it and getting their feedback and what they're dealing with. And I would just continue to work to try to find those solutions, because I do believe it's critical.
Thank you, Betsy.
I would echo what Assemblymember Barrett and what Brittany said. I also would, what I always think about when I think about childcare is how we have no maternity leave or, you know, any kind of policy at the national level, which is makes us unique among countries, and it's not a great distinction to have. It like Brittany said, it's more, we all know that we are in a crisis right now in terms of our leadership at the federal level. We possibly like we've never faced before, and it's imperative that we vote, that we get rid of who we've got right now. In addition to that, what I've seen in the, like Ulster County was able to move into place a system to take care of children of essential workers using school facilities and caregivers from places like the YMCA. In less affluent counties, I don't know what I, that's, those fixes are harder to implement, because in Greene County, for example, like there's the Y is not, it's not near anything, it's not walkable. You know, and someone in the chat mentioned public transportation, huge issue for working people in rural communities. Not everyone has a car, you know, and what we saw over and over again in these questions was that these things are all related. Childcare, transportation, healthcare, et cetera.
Great. So the next question, I'm going to ask Brittany this question. What can we do to advocate for those who are providing the care so that they can be paid a living wage? Given your experience overseeing so many employees, what can we do to provide a living wage to workers?
Yeah, I think we need to redefine the value of work. You know, we don't value, you know, my maintenance associate who is cleaning the store every hour to make sure that you're not getting sick. we're not valuing the people that are taking care of our kids and taking care of our elderly. And those, you know, maybe they're not making such a huge profit for that business, but they're providing for the society so the other people can make those huge profits for those businesses. So we need to really rethink, like I said, the way our economy works and how we value things and how we, you know, prioritize what's important. You know, our care infrastructure, like Dee Dee said, I think that's a great way to put it. And we need that kind of child care infrastructure and just those caregiving jobs in general. I obviously support a living wage, a $15 minimum wage. We need to take, you know, when we talk about all the other things like affordable housing and childcare and all of that stuff, it all ties together where the cost of living for working people is extremely expensive. You know, for me, I live with my boyfriend and my sister just to try to save money to, you know, to maybe one day own a house, to maybe one day further my education, you know, those kind of things, we're held back by that. You know, we can't reach our full potentials. We can't do the things that we want to do. You know, I have associates working 2-3 jobs, still living paycheck. My father works 80 hours a week and my mom, they live, you know, paycheck to paycheck. So we really need to value our workers, give them the money that they need, help support them, you know, be on the lines with them and bring the policies that are going to make a better world for them and make it easier for them to live in this, in our society. Because I think that's what we haven't done a good job with.
Thank you all. So there is so much intersectionality between the issues that we are discussing tonight, right? Whether it's childcare, employment, affordable housing. So that's a great segue into the next topic, which is affordable housing. And we often get the question, you know, I represent Manhattan. So when there's a lot of development happening, they say affordable for who? And that's the question that we're gonna ask ourselves tonight. Affordable for who? We know that many in our community are severely rent burdened, paying more than 50% of their income towards rents. There is a definition that says that 30% is the appropriate level to which people should be paying for a mortgage or rent. But where do you find a $600 mortgage or rental in Columbia County? That is the question. So let's go right into the subject matter. How can we begin to implement solutions that can be utilized throughout the county and move towards an affordable housing agenda? What are your thoughts around affordable housing? This question is for all three candidates. And this time we'll start with Betsy.
There, I'm unmuted now. Well, the issue of affordable housing in rural communities, you know, last year, the legislature passed universal rent control, which is fantastic, right? So now the ETPA, which is the Emergency Tenant Protection Act, right? That's what created rent control in New York City, can be applied in cities like Rochester and Syracuse, and hopefully at some point in Kingston. Unfortunately for places like Catskill, most of the housing stock is not built before 1974 in buildings of units of six or more. So it's not really applicable. In places like Greene County, had more Airbnb visitors last year than residents. So Airbnb is an issue that needs to be examined. And non-owner occupied Airbnbs, they might need to be abolished because they are depleting from the housing stock. This isn't what a lot of people want to hear, especially people who have made a business of buying buildings and making them into Airbnbs. But if they're going to be hotels, they need to be regulated like hotels and taxed like hotels. Otherwise, it's just a workaround like Uber became, you know, Uber was a workaround and, you know, was not subject to livery laws. But, you know, the law is catching up with them, right? And So minimizing Airbnb or non-owner occupied Airbnbs, you know, we don't want to punish the person who, like, I know people who, you know, retirees who've remodeled their houses so they can live in one tiny part and rent out the rest, you know, to supplement their income. We don't want to penalize those people, but we do want to have a community in which, like Brittany said, the people who work there should be able to live there. people who are cleaning bathrooms and stocking shelves should not have to live a county away because they can't afford to live where they're working anymore. So that's the main way. That's a huge component of addressing of affordable housing in a rural community.
Thank you, Betsy. Dee Dee, any thoughts on affordability?
Well, I very much agree with a lot of what Betsy just said. And I think that, it's very important that the community buy in and be engaged in the process, because diverse communities are what make living in places like Columbia County wonderful experiences, rich experiences. And, you know, the notion of being people being forced out of the communities that they grew up in is anathema to that. I mean, it's the rich diversity that makes it a vibrant and exciting place to live, particularly, you know, enjoyed in the time that I lived in Hudson. It just, you know, that's what I loved about it. And I think that that this owner-occupied Airbnb model seems to be something that we want to reinforce and we want to support. But for people to sort of run a hotel without any regulation and without paying taxes makes no sense at all. So I'm completely on board with that. I also think that we need to look at the balance between, and I know, you know, Brittany said earlier, or maybe Betsy said that she didn't believe in first time ownership, but, you know, I think that that we've seen with, for example, Habitat for Humanity in Columbia County, that first time ownership can be a very stabilizing and important step for a lot of young families and kids growing up. So I really do like this model that we've been working on, which is affordable and energy efficient. So it's affordable passive housing. The carrying costs are $100 a month, pretty much. And I think it makes sense. It's a win-win-win for environmental and economic and affordable housing issues. So, you know, that's something that I'm not giving up on. But I do agree with you that we need to find rental solutions as well that work for the community. And I've seen in too many of our towns that the moment there's an initiative, then suddenly the sort of NIMBY thing kicks in and people want no part of it. I think it's important to, I mean, what we love about living, or what I love about living in a place like Columbia County, is the sense of community and the towns. And some of them are without question more challenging than others. But I think it's important for everybody to get engaged so that you elect the town board people, and then they appoint the planning board people who represent the values that you, that you carry. And I think the opportunity now in kind of the reopening after, you know, this shut-in of COVID is to look at how we want to go forward in a values-driven way and make sure that the sustainability is economic and environmental and also just, and that those are the policies and the candidates that we support who are advocating for those issues.
Thank you, Brittany.
Yeah, I think Dee Dee and Betsy touched on all of the main points, and I agree with everything that they said. The two things that I would add, every time I would drive to work in Troy, I would drive by hundreds of vacant housing and every block, there's vacant homes, and we need to do something about that. You know, we can make those, you know, into the affordable housing units that we need. We need to talk about rezoning and inclusionary zoning and making more accessible for rental, you know, units to be a thing. You know, like Betsy said, you know, a lot of, especially my generation, you know, millennials, we're not ready to own a home, or we have so many other things going on that's not our first priority. So renting is really where we're at right now. We don't have the money saved, and you know, the wages that we're getting, we're not, you know, we don't have the money to afford a house. So renting is really where it is. We need to, you know, raise the amount of, you know, it's simple supply versus demand economics. You know, there's not enough supply of affordable housing. There's not enough supply of rental places for us to go. So I think we need to really invest in that. And as part of, like Betsy, Dee Dee said, like a Green New Deal kind of environmental, you know, infrastructure package that really brings our infrastructure from, you know, from housing to broadband to high-speed rail, like new forms of transportation, like all of those need to be included. They need to be energy efficient, and we really need to put ourselves in the right place for the future so that we can have these things that they're sustainable and that, you know, the kind of communities we want to live in the next 100 years from now. So I think that's what I'll add to that.
Thank you all.
Armin, can I just add, we did pass, I carried a bill to expand the number of land banks that we could have in New York State. And we now have an additional 25 in Dutchess County. The town and city of Poughkeepsie just started one. And that is a way to take some of these abandoned and unused properties and turn them into affordable housing and into community-owned housing that addresses what the specific community needs are.
Great points. Thank you all for indulging us on the affordable housing topic. We're a little bit over the 8:30 mark, but we're going to keep going because there's a few more questions that we want to get through. So if the panelists will indulge us for just a bit longer, we want to try and get through some of these important issues tonight. So we've talked about affordability. We've talked about childcare. None of that can happen if people can't afford to live in our communities. So we're going to talk about a fair and equal wage. We know that women on average make $80 per every dollar earned by a man. And we know that in 2017, women in Columbia County made 1.3 times less than the average man. So we want to talk about living wages. We want to talk about women and how we're going to create equity and pay parity for women across our state. So we're going to jump right in, and I'm going to ask the panelists. The first question is, where do we start? Is the policy to increase the minimum wage, or would a universal basic income like the platform that Andrew Yang put forward be more beneficial? What are your thoughts around wages for families in Columbia County? Let's start this round of questions with Dee Barrett.
Well, it's interesting that you're raising and I guess people know this, that there is a universal basic income opportunity right now in Hudson that a couple colleagues of Andrew Yang have started, Spark Foundation, and that is literally going on right now, and they're taking applications for I believe it's actually a five-year plan, which is longer than any. There's been other UBI initiatives in Oakland and some other places, which were only 3 years, but this is $500 a month for 5 years, I believe, if that I have that information correct. So we have a real opportunity to see firsthand how that works in our community here. But there's no question in my mind that we should be paying everybody a living wage, and you know that when we get complaints about construction jobs and prevailing wage and all of those things, it's like how do we say you can hold down a full-time job but you can't make enough to live on it? Doesn't make that, none of that makes sense. And we do continue, and this goes back to my point about the caregiving sector, is if you've got caregivers who are hospital workers or working in the not-for-profits who are doing home health care, who are in a range of different providing services and taking care of our most vulnerable people, they are inevitably earning way less than a lot of other jobs. And that again makes no sense. We need to make sure that these professions are paid commensurate with the value of the work they're doing. And part of that may be, and I've been working a couple years with a group of human service providers and agency people in my two counties to get our community colleges to start doing the kind of training and certification that will help this workforce sector to gain the, they used to talk about whether you had a high status or a high paid job. And we need to make sure that these kinds of jobs are both high status and high paid, and And that disproportionately impacts women, but it also disproportionately impacts people of color. And this is something that, again, as we talk about an equitable society and how we're going forward, this is something that we have to be focused on. And one last point that I just want to make is we have to elect more women to office, because I think you have to be electing people who are sensitive to these issues, as Senator Gillibrand said. I mean, this is where the conversations are happening. They're not happening at a lot of events where it's mostly men that are gathering.
Thank you. Brittany, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, so talking about the gender pay gap in general, that really comes down to childcare. A lot of the reasons that there is that child or gender pay gap is because women can't work as much, paid work, we say, versus unpaid work, where you're taking care of your kids and you're taking care of your house, and those things aren't valued as much as, going to your job and making that paycheck. So that's really where the gender pay, discrepancy comes in, and how we fix that is by, having that universal childcare, having that ability for mothers to have access to childcare, any time of the day, so that they aren't held back by the fact that, they have a child at home and maybe they're sick and now they can't go to work and, they need extra days off. I really do think that's one of those things that really hold us back still. We fought so hard for our rights and we need like some childcare rights where, they're not holding us back. You want to have children in a society to keep the doors moving. So we need to value that and give women the ability to focus on the careers and make a living for themselves and for their children, and giving them that opportunity. So I believe I've already said that I believe we need living wage. We need $15 minimum wage, but we also need to take care of the cost of living. One of the things that I care about deeply is universal healthcare. The amount of money that my mom, I personally understand the burdens of healthcare debt. My mom gets a $3,000 Remicade treatment every couple months. She's never going to escape her medical debt that she has. Her prescriptions, every time her prescription drugs go up, she struggles. It hurts her wallet. Those living paycheck to paycheck, those dollars add up. So it's not just about your wages, it's about how much things cost and the price gouging and how much these corporations and these industries get away with raising those costs to these insane levels that put so much more burden on working people. The cost of education shouldn't cost $200,000 to get an education. I'm sorry, it's not worth $200,000 to, be a productive member of society. All those kind of what I call like a scam and a sham, those institutions need to be revised. We need to bring down those costs of living, be reasonable about what we expect from people of society, what we want them to do. We want them to get an education. We want them to better themselves and make a, get those jobs that they want and, where their passion is. And we can't keep holding them back. So it starts with a minimum wage and it continues with bringing those costs of living down.
Thank you, Brittany. So this is a hot topic in the chat. I see here some very, very important comments, including comments around home care and other industries that offer poverty wages filled by women of color and immigrants. It's also a social and racial justice issue, as was pointed out by Christine. We're also seeing some comments around the pay gap existing in every industry. So I'm going to reframe the question for Betsy, and I'm gonna say, Betsy, what's the role of government in closing the gender pay gap? What do you believe?
Oh, the gender pay gap?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I don't know, to be frank. I don't know what the government could do to make sure that women are paid the same as men. I do agree with Brittany on as far as the value of a college education. I'm $80,000 in debt right now for my master's in social work, because I didn't feel like I had a choice. I had to do something so I could stay here. I got priced out of Kingston. I moved to Greene County. All I know is that if there was an easy answer, we might have tried it already. one thing that I think that is happening to for girls is an emphasis on STEM programs and finding where the performance, you know, when girls stop raising their hands, you know, when that happens in school, when it stops being cool to be smart, and moving to fix that, because that's not, we can't let that happen to our girls. We need to take care of them, and we need to, you know, this is tied to, you know, the culture of school and bullying and you know, picking on kids that are different, which is usually connected to poverty again. So,
well, I think that this is exactly how we do it. We bring it to the forefront, we address right. it, we talk about it head on, and we don't make any apologies for ensuring that women are paid the same as men. So thank you, ladies, for that insight. So we're going to move on to an issue where women are leading. And given what's happening in California and in Oregon at this moment, I think it's so important that we're talking about this. Didi touched on it a little while ago as well. We're going to talk about the environment and sustainability. So studies by the UN in 2013 and 2017 point out that women worldwide are more concerned about the climate crisis and the environmental degradation. The two most prominent climate activists today are two young women, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Greta Thunberg. Those shouting them down are primarily older conservative men. Our active participation as women is crucial to ending the climate crisis. Can you all elaborate, each one of you, each of the panelists, elaborate, what are your thoughts around the climate crisis and how we can begin to repair some of the damage that we've done to Mother Earth?
Do you want me to start?
Sure.
Well, it certainly is, you know, here in the Hudson Valley, we're very cognizant of our natural resources and the threats to them. And, you know, we have worked for decades to clean up the Hudson and to address, you know, to make sure that our soils are kept healthy. And, you know, my carbon farming initiative has been, you know, very much driven by that nexus, that sweet spot between agriculture and environmental concerns. But, you know, I think in the bigger picture, we have to be developing the green infrastructure that creates the jobs. You know, one of the big challenges in the Hudson Valley is that we are losing young people. We have one of the oldest populations here in Columbia County, and we are not attracting young families. We're not attracting. We have very few hospitals even in the region that actually deliver babies anymore. We just lost one of the hospitals in Dutchess County that provided pediatric care. So we're kind of going out of our way to, you know, to not need a younger generation when we absolutely need them. And so I think a lot of that has to do with the Green New Deal jobs that we have to be creating. And you know, that's got to happen here. I think we can do some of that very easily. Broadband is one of the obstacles to it when it, you know, when you're dealing with the tech industry to a certain extent and some of the, you know, the remote businesses that people want to start. But, you know, we're, I mean, and there's always two sides to this. We're struggling in one of my counties, in one of my towns right now in Copaic. I don't know if there's other people here from Copaic. But there is a 900-acre solar farm that wants to move in to an old, longtime farm, you know, right in the view shed. And so it's that balance of making sure that we have the jobs and we have the projects that will move us forward and help us reach our goals, but not at the same time totally destroy the economic base, which is tourism and agriculture and recreational activities in, you know, in our region as well. So none of this is simple, but I think there's no question that has to be a priority. And we're so fortunate so far to, you know, to have the rain and have the water here, but you know, and be able to do the farming that we're that we do here. I've been reading articles on agriculture that, you know, that say, obviously the Central Valley in California and, you know, the farms in the Midwest are not the future of agriculture. And I really believe that the way we have done things in parts of the Hudson Valley with small family farms is sustainable for the future, but we've got to give people, we've got the opportunity to make money doing that. And you know, that's another dimension to this, which is actually having food cost what it really costs, so that farmers are, their livelihoods are sustainable as well. Those are some thoughts.
Thank you, Didi. Betsy?
I just wanted to, I don't want to take too long, but I wanted to say that not only is it the future of our planet, it's the future of our party. And if we look at Ed Markey's race and the amount of momentum he gathered from young people who mobilized to bring him out in front, because he had the values that were important to them. And I think, and when we're thinking about the things like the Green New Deal, we have to, it's what we have to do. It's not some sort of kooky lefty fantasy. You know, this is, if we want a planet to live on, these are the things that we have to do.
Thank you, Betsy. Brittany, any thoughts on climate crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely one of my main motivating factors, you know, as a young person, as someone who's thinking not just 5, 10, 15 years from now, but 100 years from now, 200 years from now, we need to think that far ahead, especially as elected officials and how we're planning for governments of the future. If we're going to have a sustainable democracy, we need a sustainable environment where people can live in a healthy, you know, environment and keep their kids drinking safe water and clean air. So I think that's very important. In terms of agriculture, you know, working in a grocery store every single day, I walk through my produce department and see the out of stocks and see, you know, what regions are being impacted today and why we have, you know, most people don't understand that your food comes from all around the world. And we might not have those same opportunities 10, 15, 20 years from now that we do today, like Didi said, where we're getting our food supply. I think food supply is a food secure as a national security issue. You know, we saw just in March when we had those food shortages and the supply chain was completely disrupted, how impactful that was and what would have happened if those didn't rebound the way that they did. Even though it still took them a while, you know, they rebounded. I had a customer buy an entire cart of chicken breasts. We never actually ran out of meat, but everyone could see, you could feel the fear in the air of what happens if there's no food. So it's really important that we have those food supplies, that we're focused on local farming. And I also pivot that to food security for our food pantries. You know, I work a lot with the Regional Food Bank, and they have a Patroon land farm where they grow the food and then deliver it right to the food bank and distributes to the food pantries. We need more programs like that. We need more farms like that that are going to keep our kids and our working families and our families that are struggling healthy. I'm a major advocate for the Green New Deal. I think it's, we're in an economic depression, whether you can feel it or not right now, a lot of people are, it's coming for us. And we, the only way we're going to get out of it is having, you know, big, bold ideas of how we can transform our economy, how we can, you know, like I said, we're in the childcare of the 1950s institutions. We're also in the energy, you know, economy of the 1950s, where it's completely focused on these fossil fuels and coal and things that, yes, they were important in the energy. You know, they were new technologies back then. But now we are finding the technology sector is only expanding more and more. We're going to have more renewable resources, we're going to have more capacity for storage and things like that, and we should be putting our resources, you know, our R&D research and doing everything we can to expand that. I think it's atrocious that we don't subsidize renewables, but we are, you know, well off subsidizing fossil fuels that are only destroying our environment, and we're not even holding those fossil fuel companies liable to their waste. So I'm also upset about the public, you know, the public takes all the loss and the corporation takes all of the profit. That needs to change. I call myself a Teddy Roosevelt progressive for that kind of reason, because you need the balance of the public interest and the private interest, and the private interest can't have it all anymore. We need to really balance, you know, how, what we care about, our priorities as a government, as a democracy. You can't keep contaminating our water. One of the main things in my county, in Rensselaer County, is the Dunn landfill. It's located 200 feet away from a school. You know, this landfill is full of carcinogens. It's contaminating these children. They're going to grow up with health issues, and no one's doing anything about it. And it was allowed to happen to begin with, which I just feel is morally outrageous. You know, it's one of those things. It's like, how do we get to this place? How do we allow that? And we need to really focus on the hazardous materials that are in everything, and how we're recycling, and what happened to all those green initiatives that I, you know, just 10 years ago, everyone was focused on it. And now it's kind of, you know, gone to the wayside. No one cares anymore. I care about that. It's one of the many things that we need to do to bring our economy forward. You know, with that Green New Deal, you have the broadband infrastructure, you have, like I said, the high speed rail. You know, how are we going to transform our transportation systems? How do we get to Rensselaer to New York City in 2 hours? You know, those things are possible. We have the capability. We just need to invest in that kind of infrastructure. It's going to bring our society to the next level. It's going to bring those new jobs. You know, broadband will bring those service jobs that we don't even know about yet. You know, I think we really need to focus on fighting that future and saving the environment at the same time. I think we can do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Brittany. Thank you, Dee Dee. Thank you, Betsy. And most of all, thank you to the Columbia County Women's Alliance for bringing us together tonight. I'm going to pass it back to Anne Israel. Thank you for the invitation.
Wow. What an amazing panel. We could have gone on for hours here. There was so much to say. Carmen, I can't thank you enough for the fantastic job you did moderating this panel. And of course, I want to thank all of you who showed up for this interesting and informative evening. Special thanks to our very special guest speakers, Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul and U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. How exciting to have them here with us. And Dee Dee, Brittany, Betsy, thank you so much. You really gave us a lot of food for thought. I also want to thank Lynn Sloniker of, she's the station manager of WGKC, and they're also their managing news editor, and she has recorded all of this. The information is up on the chat feature. If you feel you are not going to be able to go to your poll, please sign up to get your absentee ballot if you haven't done so yet. And that address will be up on the chat feature. It's absenteeballot.elections.org.gov. Really important to get those absentee ballots so we can also elect all these women that spoke tonight. Special thanks to Elizabeth DePalma for her magnificent invitation to this event and for reminding me that God does not play dice with the universe. And also to Karen Fetty for keeping track of all of you so meticulously and perfectly. And lastly, but not least, a world of thanks to the amazing Claire Ackerman. Without her, this event never would have happened. So thank you again for attending this special forum. We hope that if you've not already joined the CCWA, you will do so by going to our Facebook page and joining, and Claire is going to put that up. So all the websites of our participants tonight also are up, so you can learn more about them before you place your vote, and also hopefully to support them. Thank you, everyone. This was a really exciting evening for me. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.